We are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So, yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
Really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
That was the voice of the great Lyndon Baines Johnson, who was unfortunately followed, eventually by Richard Nixon. And of course, everyone has heard of Richard Nixon, but I bet very few, if any, listeners have heard of the man who Nixon lied about and whose career was destroyed in order to launch Nixon's trajectory, which would lead to the presidency. Did you ever hear the name Alger Hiss? About a quarter century before Nixon's lies, which caused the loss of lives and limbs in Vietnam and Cambodia, but boosted his status, and before the better-known break-in and cover-up at the Democratic headquarters at the Watergate Hotel, Nixon was a young congressman from California. In a new book called Alger Hiss, Framed, A New Look at the Case That Made Richard Nixon Famous, our guest today, author Joan Brady, wrote what one reviewer called a bracing reminder of what indeed was so hateful, so villainous about Nixon and his political ascent, end of quote. And according to former Chicago 8 defendant John Wiener, professor of history at University of California, this book, Alger Hiss Framed, will introduce a new generation to the trial that transformed America. And Victor Navasky, publisher emeritus of The Nation, calls this book an ever-fascinating story. It will be of interest not merely to scholars of the case, but anyone who cares about history and getting it right. Well, we are learning these days that politics can turn on a dime. It was nearly 70 years ago that within less than a week, Alger Hiss's life as a public servant was over. And an obscure junior member of Congress was launched on his way to the White House. A question has been left hanging since that moment in 1948. Was Alger Hiss a Soviet agent and the greatest traitor in American history, or was he the innocent victim of a vicious, politically motivated frame-up? With us today from somewhere in England is author Joan Brady. Joan, thanks for being with us.
Hello, it's Oxford.
Oh, Oxford, that's a lovely town.
Yeah. Well, so you know.
I was there fairly recently, 1972.
Oh. What do you know?
Yeah, 45 years ago. Anyway, Joan Brady is the first woman and American to win the distinguished Whitbread Book of the Year for Theory of War, which reveals the facts that have kept Alger Hiss a villain for decades. Joan Brady is an American-British writer and author of several works of fiction and nonfiction. Her first nonfiction book, Theory of War, received Francis Prix du Meilleur Livre Étranger and the Whitbread Book of the Year Award. Alger Hiss is Ms. Brady's second work of nonfiction this fall. She'll be a featured panelist at Reexamining the Early Cold War, 1945 to 1953, a symposium that's being held at NYU. Well, again, thanks for being with us. It was so long ago. How did you come to write this book? I believe the story has a personal aspect to it, going back to 1960. Please tell us about your first meeting with Alger Hiss.
Well, it goes back to 1960 because he came to dinner in 1960. Hmm. I was involved with a man quite a bit my senior his name was Dexter Masters, and he was the director of Consumers Union. And he got a telephone call one day that began, "My name is Alger Hiss."
Okay.
And this was after Alger had got out of prison, and he had been stripped of his ability to practice law, of course, mm-hmm. and he had, you know, he stood in lines the way people do who have no money, and he looked for jobs. The first job he got was selling women's barrettes. And the second job he got had to do with paper selling. And he had called Consumers Union in order to see if he could sell them some paper. And he had found that if he opened his patter with "This is Alger Hiss," he often got attention that other people wouldn't get.
He
apparently was a very good salesman. He sold quite a lot so that people could, at their next cocktail party, say, "Guess who's trying to sell me paper clips?"
Oh, jeez.
It's marvelous. Anyway, Dexter, the Consumers Union, Consumer Reports, had too large a print run for this company to handle, so he asked him to dinner. And so that was how I met him.
And who was Alger Hiss before the big brouhaha of 1945. I understand there are actual photographs of Alger Hiss with Franklin Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill at the 1945 conference at Yalta, planning the world at the end of the war. Who was Alger?
He'd risen through the State Department,
uh-huh.
As I guess young men do, or did back then, yeah. And he had become so good at what he did that he organized the United Nations. He was the one, he was organized. In effect the United Nations first Secretary General. He was its organizing Secretary General.
Wow.
And when that was done, he became the president of the Carnegie Endowment for Peace, International Peace, I guess it is. And everybody thought he'd be the next Secretary of State or something.
Wow.
But that was not to be.
And it's funny, as you say that, about him organizing the UN. I've been around many years, and for a long time, it was the far right, the John Birch Society, who today might be considered relatively moderate within the Republican Party.
Yeah.
But they were bumper stickers saying, "Get the U.S. out of the UN, get the UN out of the U.S. And I'm guessing maybe that sentiment and, you know, linking this guy Alger Hiss with, you know, communism maybe had something to do with it.
I think it's really impossible to say. I mean, this had to do with the House Un-American Activities Committee,
right,
which is a very queer
tip.
House
yeah.
committee.
Oh, yes.
And it was naming everybody. They named Roosevelt. They named Eleanor Roosevelt. They named anybody who was in the government. They named all kinds of people who weren't in the government. They were really quite, it was quite a weird thing. I mean, they had literally no legal restraints. And all of this stuff, when they named these people, it was in the papers. They published the names in the papers.
Right.
And they had... Before this, they had brought down the 10 Hollywood
yes.
writers, you know, the Trumbo story.
Trumbo. Very good movie, by the way.
Yeah, very good movie. And but they had brought these people down, and
yes.
all these people had done was refuse to name their friends.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that was all they had done. They had kept silent. They'd called themselves the Committee of the First Amendment. The idea being that if you were tried for the Fifth Amendment, you were branded as a Fifth Amendment communist to begin with.
It's marvelous,
isn't it? And also, if you did take the Fifth, there's always the implication that you have committed a crime.
Right.
And they wouldn't want to admit anything like that. I mean, it was the Communist Party was a legal party.
Yes.
It had offices in New York. Membership was legal. It put out papers. It backed candidates for president and for various other offices.
Of course. You know, I always thought, you know, we have nothing to fear from the communist ideology, from Karl Marx. People aren't buying it, especially here in America. So, you know, and I don't know what other crimes may have been associated with being a communist, aside from the obvious Rosenberg case where, yeah, okay, they were communists, but it's dubious. That's another story, but it's from the same era. That was from 1953. And if you just tuned in to Keeping Democracy Alive, Bert Cohen here. Our guest today is Joan Brady, author of a new book, Alger Hiss, Framed, a new look at the case that made Nixon famous. Now, many school children being taught about the early days of the Cold War, if they hear the name Alger Hiss at all, associate him with somebody like Benedict Arnold, a traitor. How did he come to be labeled a traitor and a spy, then tried in criminal court and sent to prison?
He wasn't tried as a spy. This was an exceedingly odd situation, the whole thing. When Alger's name was published in the New York Times as a communist suspect, I mean, some guy had said, yeah, Alger Hiss is a communist. And most of the time, most sophisticated people, was just to forget it. And all of Alger's friends said, just forget it, let it blow over. It's nothing. But Alger, he was a very principled guy, and he thought, no, this has gone far enough. So he challenged them to hear his denial under oath of any charges. And he went down to Washington, and he appeared before HUAC, and the standard, that's what the House on American right. Activities is, an acronym for that.
Right.
And they asked him if he was a communist, and he said no. And you know, they did that usual thing.
Mm-hmm.
But they never mentioned the charges. And he kept bringing them up himself, you know. But they would not talk about them. And in the end, he went away thinking that he'd sort of handled this, but not very well, because he'd not denied the charges simply because they wouldn't talk about them. But the papers the next morning talked about Nixon cracking the spy case. And Alger was now put in the newspapers as the accused. I mean, this is an astonishing thing. He was suddenly the accused, and there was this panel that was going to fly to New York to interview a mystery witness. And this mystery witness would reveal all kinds of things, and you couldn't say who it was. Well, the man who had accused Alger was a man called Whitaker Chambers, who's a very, very odd man. And when the HUAC panel got to New York, this was not known at the time, of course, the mystery witness was Chambers again. And the mystery witness was supposed to be revealing that everything Chambers had said was obviously true. It sounds so batty that it's difficult to describe. And you can now see this particular, you can see all the hearings, they're all online.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's really quite remarkable, they're all there. I mean, I couldn't have done this book 15 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Because his things just weren't available. But they got to this hearing, and there was Nixon, and there were several other of the HUAC members, and there was Chambers.
Yes.
And they had a few little discussions. Nixon asked him if he remembered anything about Alger's house, and he said, well, he remembered a red cigarette case. Could he remember anything about furniture? No. Could he remember anything about the books? No. Could he remember anything? He couldn't remember anything. And then at one point, Chambers says, can we go off the record?
And this was at the committee hearing?
An official House hearing on espionage. And the witness says, can we go off the record? Nixon says, yeah. So they go off the record. They're off the record for 2.5 hours.
Oh, my God.
Nobody has any idea what was said.
Why am I reminded of the 18-and-a-half-minute gap?
I wouldn't have any idea.
Uh-huh.
Now, and this there were many more gaps of similar sorts. But this was just an astonishing thing.
Yes.
And one thing that became important was the date 1938.
Yes, and go ahead.
And for years, Chambers had said, and under oath, he was so eager to be a spy, or to have been a spy, that he would swear under oath that he had given up being a spy in 1937. And the very last question that is asked in this hearing is, when did you last see Alger Hiss? 1937. The very first question that is asked when the hearing resumes 2.5 hours later, so the last time you saw Alger Hiss was 1938.
Uh-huh.
He's gained a year, and you think, you know, you can't, this is just so odd. And then it turns out that he presents some papers as papers that Alger handed to him. They're all dated 1938.
Wow, that makes such a huge difference.
Yeah. I mean, it's so clearly a setup. That's the thing that's so astonishing about. But of course, people couldn't see these things then. This was not only, you know, a congressional hearing, but an executive one. So I'm not quite sure when the transcripts were published, but way too late for Alger.
Yeah.
And the same thing true for the first one. I mean, nobody could publish what was actually stated. They just could report on what they'd heard.
Wow, what they'd heard. Boy, that's a heck of a way to convict somebody.
The thing that was remarkable was that what would come out then afterwards was that this mystery witness, whom they never named, had actually affirmed everything that that Whittaker Chambers had said about Alger, including all kinds of details about his household. They didn't have, I mean, when you read the thing and all he can remember is a cigarette case, and then the newspaper comes out saying this mystery witness has remembered all kinds of details. This is very odd. But of course, Alger was under very intensive surveillance. He had been. He was as a member of the government. Everybody in the government at his level was under surveillance of one sort or another. I mean, and the FBI had expressed there was a law passed. I've forgotten what it was called, but a law passed that if they had any suspicion that anybody was a communist or was subversive in any way, whatever, that was, they had to report it. They never did.
Absolutely amazing. I mean, as you say, astonishing. And it makes me think about fear and how politicians through the years have manipulated fear for their own political gain. I mean, this was such a fearsome period. I mean, I will acknowledge I was born in 1950, so I remember a little bit of this stuff and the fear of communism and how it worked very well for certain politicians, and obviously...
Oh, boy. I mean, and this is how Nixon was really... That's how he got into Congress.
Oh.
Was red-baiting.
Oh, and that was, if I remember correctly, Helen Gehagen Douglas?
No, that was... This was Jerry Voorhees. Helen Gehagen was for the Senate seat, which I think came... I think that was... It was actually 1950 that was run. But for your birthday... But, you know, this was a guy called Jerry Voorhees, who was an anti-communist of considerable... He'd even been a member of HUAC.
Really?
Yeah, but there's a one point in... but Nixon kept saying that he was a communist, and he had whole telephone campaigns in which people would call up and say, do you know that Jerry Voorhees is a communist?
Oh, my.
He did the same thing with Helen Gehagen Douglas.
And that's how Nixon was elected in 1948?
Well, he had huge amounts of money. This is still a mystery. Nobody knows where all the money came from.
Yeah, that was my next question.
Yeah. Well, the thing that's very odd about Nixon, I mean, there are a lot of theories about it, and I think the best thing you can say is that he was backed by the oil companies. The amount of money, there was one, and he was also backed by Mickey Cohen, who was the great mobster who appears even in, you know, in movies, Hollywood movies, as himself practically. But he fronted the Nixon campaign.
The oil money, the pollution, you know, environmental pollution as well as political pollution of the oil interests is just amazing. And, you know, the oil companies were not supposed to aid the fascists in the Spanish Civil War, but they did. It was illegal. But
indeed, they aided the Nazis in the...
They did.
In World War II. Yeah, I mean, there's quite a bit of information on that.
Yeah.
So, the amount of double dealing was really quite extraordinary.
And as Bob Dylan once said, money doesn't talk, it swears. I mean, it was really ugly how much power the oil companies had and obviously still have.
And
I was wondering, you know, how did Nixon pick Alger Hiss to go after? And I thought it was interesting to read that...
He didn't, actually. Alger volunteered, you see. He demanded to be able... He demanded to deny this under oath. They were looking for a scapegoat. I mean, one of the people suggested a guy called... I can't think of his name at the moment, but he was, you know, a labor union guy who would have been pretty good. When Alger volunteered... demanded this hearing, and then during the hearing, it's quite interesting to watch through the transcript what's going on. Alger's very sort of sarcastic and contemptuous of the hearing throughout, but Nixon does appear, does press him a bit, and it's clear that he's pretty unpleasant, Nixon. And when this is over with, my feeling is that Nixon knew this was a guy he could beat. Nixon was such a dirty fighter.
Oh, yes.
And Alger never encountered anybody like that before.
So it wasn't expected. He thought the guy would play fair.
He thought he could beat the lot of them. They were very, except for Nixon, they were very stupid men. They must have been just stunned to find this brilliant creature amongst them.
So, the conviction of Hiss by the House Un-American Activities Committee was considered a crowning achievement of that committee, and others...
No, it's the only thing they ever did. They didn't convict him, they just set him up.
They set him up. Yeah. Others were called before that witch hunt committee, and it really was a witch hunt. They took the Fifth Amendment. And they invoked their constitutional right to remain silent. Again, why did Hiss not do this, and how do you think it doomed him? Did he unwittingly participate in his own destruction by not taking the Fifth? It sounds like he probably did, by being brave and thinking, well, the truth will win out.
He believed in the law.
Whoa.
He found the thing, his response to what happened to him was shock that the legal system had failed him. This is what he believed in all his life, and it had failed.
Wow. Yeah, we like to believe in justice. We really do. You know, people still do. And, you know, interesting more about Nixon, and this says a lot about who Nixon was. On his White House tapes, Nixon was heard to say of the Hiss case, quote, "I convicted him in the press. I played them like a master." So
he did indeed.
Congressman Nixon more or less invented fake news in the Hiss case?
I would say so. He certainly made vast use of it. It's just extraordinary when you find that somebody who has come to deny something and is not allowed to deny it, and the next day the headlines are that Nixon is cracking open the spy case. There is no case. He's not even been accused of anything. And then within a week, he is the accused, and he has this mystery witness, who turns out to be Whitaker Chambers, verifying everything Whitaker Chambers says, which was nothing so far. It is the most astonishing thing. And his life was over. His public life was over, Alger's.
And he would be famous probably, these, you know, still in history, for organizing the United Nations, if not for this.
Yes, indeed. In fact, there was a huge photograph in Life of him coming back from Paris, I guess, with the charter in his, you know, in his possession.
We all have heard it said that the truth is stranger than fiction. This is certainly a case of
that. I thought of doing this as a novel. And then I thought, no, it's just too fantastical.
People wouldn't think, you know, how can you think of this crazy stuff that actually happens? So what...
Well, I mean, people have probably forgotten about the pumpkin too.
Well, I wanted to ask about that, of course. What is this, the pumpkin papers, you know, and looking at history and having an appreciation for actual history, which is one reason we're talking about this, is because that myth is so much easier to learn than actual history. There, you know, any kind of easily memorable short phrase. Pumpkin papers. What is that? Tell us about that, please.
Well, Alger, not only he was clearly, if he was a spy, he was so bad at it. You're never supposed to beard your agent provocateur, and that's what he did. He sued Chambers for this, for saying these things.
Well, that's understandable.
And during the deposition, before, you know, the deposition about the suit, he came up with these papers, the ones that I was mentioning, that all were dated 1938. And Alger saw them and said, well, there's nothing really secret here, but they should go to the Justice Department. He shouldn't have had them, whatever they are. And they were sent to the Justice Department, who said exactly the same thing Alger did. There's nothing here.
Hmm.
Nobody has broken any laws. So Chambers came up with a second bombshell. This was a pumpkin containing film. Mm-hmm. It had two reels of film and three canisters. And Nixon brought all of this. He said he wasn't going to show them to the Justice Department because that was filled with communists. And clearly he would never be able to, you know, you could never get them to assess something like this honestly. So the grand jury subpoenaed him, or he went to the grand jury with these three canisters and two films. And he said the three canisters, they were nothing to pay any attention to. But the two films were of top secret documents that were locked away in an office in Alger's department.
Uh-huh.
And Alger, they should be looked at. And the person, but he was working under a guy called Sayre. And they subpoenaed Sayre, and Sayre said he couldn't understand how they got the idea that these were secret. They weren't secret at all. They were delivered in a shopping cart.
Mm-hmm. And what were they doing in a pumpkin?
Well, they were doing that in a pumpkin because that was so dramatic. Chambers had got it from a Soviet film about spying. And they were in this pumpkin, and it was such a hoo-ha-ha. And what Chambers said was that the pumpkin, it was absurd, but it worked. But then the moment that that Sayre had debunked the films, the canisters became the very secret thing. Because this was a grand jury thing, of course, it's entirely secret. It's only come out recently what actually happened. And also the contents of the canisters came out. And what they contained, Nixon said this, they contained evidence of the greatest treason in American history.
Mm.
What they actually contained was pages from maintenance manuals.
Maintenance of what?
Things like you must paint fire extinguishers silver rather than red.
Uh-huh.
they were apparently from the public shelves of the Library of Standards.
Oh my goodness. Real dangerous stuff. I can see that. Oh my goodness.
Well, it wouldn't have mattered. It could have been the Ladies' Home Journal. What was important was the sense of secrecy. And throughout the trials, these were not mentioned, of course, but everybody knew about them. That's where the real secret was, and it could not be revealed because even then, even 10 years after the war, and 10 years, you know, they would be so dangerous to national security.
Wow, whipping up fear once again, just on not even knowing what it is, and it's incredible.
It's always seemed to me that the scariest sci-fi films were the ones where you never actually saw of the creature.
Ah, good point. Good point. That's, yeah. Oh, my. Because once you saw the creature, it's like, this is obvious.
Yeah, well, then you sort of, you know, you can rest a little bit.
Well,
nobody knew anything about these things.
And there was really nothing in there. Well, this guy, Whitaker Chambers, who you know, whenever you heard the name in you know, elementary school, Alger Hiss, you'd hear the name Whitaker Chambers, who still, I believe, remains a hero to the American right and was actually awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by President Reagan in 1984. So who was... He testified that Alger Hiss was a communist. What do you think may have motivated him, Whitaker Chambers, to do what he did?
Well, he'd started it a long time ago. I mean, he was a crazy man. It really can't be helped. He just wasn't right in the head. But that's not what caused him to do this. His upbringing was very, very odd. His mother slept with an axe under the bed because she felt that a woman with an axe was the equal of any man. He himself slept with a knife. This is when he's 8 years old. Hmm. His grandmother ran around the house screaming all the time, apparently Alzheimer's or syphilis or something.
Uh-huh.
It was a very odd house. The father was away often. And when he went to school, he had a very hard time at the beginning because he was weird.
Right.
But as he got a little older, he became even weirder, but he was such an attention seeker that the kids sort of pay attention because he was such an attention seeker. He would stand up, he would climb up places nobody else would go just to look threatening and, you know, to make people afraid. But he started writing stories about spies. He was a very gifted writer.
Hmm.
But he started in high school writing these stories about spies. And he became obsessed with spies.
Uh-huh.
And he went to Columbia after this. There was a period at Williams College, which he ran away from, saying that he was being pursued by the devil. But he then went to Columbia, where he got thrown out for writing a play about Jesus Christ as a queen. And he joined the Communist Party at some point in here. I'm not quite sure where. Nobody is.
Whitaker Chambers did.
Sorry?
Whitaker Chambers did.
Yeah. He joined the Communist Party, and he wrote for the Daily Worker a little later on, but and also for the New Masses, two of the legal publications that these people put out. But he also worked at the library, public library, and the thing that's so mad is that he got thrown out because he was saying that he had communist material, or his locker was searched because he was saying he had communist material in his locker. And there was a communist cell in the library, and he had proof of it in his locker. And the police came, and they searched his locker, and all they found was books stolen from Columbia. But he was a guy really who wanted to be somebody, to do something. And he flailed around, and one of the things he thought of doing, there was a man called Walter Kravitsky, who was actually a spy, and he became a real celebrity for a short period as, you know, he brought out his spy confessions. And Chambers was really smitten, so he wrote his own confessions as a spy. And he... there's absolutely no evidence that he actually was a spy.
Right.
But he did this business of writing these confessions, and
well,
he would go around and confess to anybody who'd listen to him. And the number of spies that he knew got larger and smaller, and it changed and fluctuated. Alger was almost always on his lists, I think, but...
Uh-huh. Well, I wanted to ask, Whitaker Chambers eventually worked for Time magazine.
He was a very gifted writer.
And they paid his legal costs Well, I mean, yeah. What does that say about justice or not?
Well, it says quite a bit about the Luce family, I think, who owned
Time
at the time.
Right.
And they had him first on the foreign desk, and they had to take him off because by this time he had become a rabid anti-communist. Well, I suppose if you're going to write your memoirs, you're going to become a rabid anti. You've got to become a rabid anti-communist.
Oh, sure.
But I don't think it speaks very well for Luce, but you can see why they did it. I mean, it was a very, very lucrative thing for them.
Right. Well, and didn't that affect? I mean, you know, there's an old saying: you don't get in arguments with interested by their ink by the barrel. And they did. I mean, Time magazine had a lot of influence. Still do. And, you know, how did... I can't imagine how that played in this whole, witch hunt that happened.
Well, I think they were, you know, I'm sure witch burnings were very well attended.
True.
This was
very entertaining, yes.
Yeah, this is the same thing. Oh, gosh, look, we've got a new one to throw... things. And one of the things that's so sad is the number of lives that were ruined by these people.
Yes.
Not necessarily by Time, but by the HUAC people. I mean, they were involved in doing this for 30 years. They destroyed thousands of people, and the only thing that makes them feel they did anything right is Alger.
Because nothing else stuck?
No, nothing else ever stuck. They put a lot of people away. I mean, they put those 10 Hollywood writers away, but not for crimes. It was for contempt of Congress, for refusing to answer.
Hmm. If you just tuned in, fascinating story. Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. We're talking with Joan Brady about her new book, Alger Hiss, Framed, a new look at the case that made Nixon famous. Well, this question has been asked before, but about a different case. What did Nixon know, and when did he know it?
Oh, Nixon knew Nixon set the whole thing up. It's perfectly clear from the hearings and from the from the newspapers. You can see exactly how it got set up, and I mean, there's even a little bit about the executive hearing that follows his Alger's first hearing, in which they're discussing that Nixon says, "I think he's lying," but he says, "There's no way we can prove that he was a communist." I mean, this is, of course, stupid, because it would have been easy. You'd just look on the news, and this was a legal organization. But anyway, he said, there's no way we can prove that he was a communist. But if we can prove he lied about Whitaker Chambers, we can get him for perjury. This is right after Alger has asked to deny the charges and has not really been given the chance to do so.
Oh,
this is that afternoon.
Oh, my. After he had walked away thinking he had done a good job and probably stood up to them and just did justice.
I think he has to have been nervous. I mean, he's a very intelligent man. And if you go to deny charges and are not allowed to do so, it's very odd.
And
they kept showing him pictures of a man he couldn't recognize. It was Chambers.
Because he didn't really know him. Right?
Well, he didn't really know. He had met him, years before, I guess 13 years before, they had met. And, in fact, Chambers had stayed in his apartment for a while. He sublet it. Alger was in between leases, and he sublet this apartment. But there was, you know, it was perfectly clear that he didn't know Alger at all. Alger's stepson had a very severe accident and was in plaster and things in the living room. Chambers doesn't remember any of that. All he remembered was a red cigarette case.
Well, you told us about what happened to Alger Hiss and that Whitaker Chambers got that Presidential Medal of Freedom.
Yeah.
What happened with his life? How successful or whatever was he? I mean, this guy, Alger Hiss, who had done a lot of really good things, was
basically
destroyed.
He did try a few more times. There were a couple other guys he tried to get in the same way he got Alger, but he never got anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble is that the trial had really broken him in terms of his relationship with time. He could no longer do that. I'm not quite sure why. I don't see why not. But anyway, he stopped with time. He did write another book called Cold Friday with his various memoirs of other things. He was a very good writer.
So we had two
a little
good writers.
On the elaborate side, I'd say, but you know, he wrote really well, and his rendition or his telling of the tale is really quite something, and made a bestseller. And it's, I think, not long ago had its 50th anniversary printing. It's an enormously popular book still.
And it's his story of the his side of the case?
Well, it's his entire story of his being a communist and all this cloak and dagger. And I mean, one of the things that seemed to me amazing was that nobody in Alger's team bothered to look into the absolute absurdity of Chambers as a spy. I mean, it was just absurd. He was running around the village in the early 1930s telling everybody he was a secret Soviet agent with the FBI after him all the time. Then he says he quit and he hid for years because the Soviets were after him for quitting. Then he talks about going, you know, his relationship with Alger and how they became the closest of friends, and how he visited Alger's house once a week to, you know, to exchange these documents that he was going to send to, going to have typed and sent to,
to
Stalin, who would not accept such things. I mean, all the spy people who have read this simply say it is absurd.
Oh, my goodness. This must have been...
not the way spies behave. You cannot run around being best friends with your source.
This must have been... I'm trying to imagine what it was like doing this research. It took you, you know, a long time to actually write this thing and to finish it. But just the research for this must have been fascinating. And I just,
it was wonderful. If he would run across these gems, like this 2.5 hours that was missing, just missing.
Yeah. You know, a lot of history, and you talk about, you know, Joseph Stalin, who was... not a good guy, let's face it.
Oh, he wasn't really a good guy either.
No. A lot of history was discovered among the Soviet KGB archives that were opened fairly recently. What did they show about this Alger Hiss and Whitaker Chambers?
They have nothing on Chambers at all. They have nothing on Alger. There is no denying that Alger appears in some Soviet stuff because he was, you know, he was who he was. But not as a spy. The way this all began was that there was an unknown decoder at the FBI during the period when Alger was being sentenced. One of these cables was called Venona 1822, and it referred to a spy called Alesh. And this unknown decoder said, likely to be Alger Hiss. That's all. That's the entirety of the identification of Alger with Alesh. What I found, I think, most shocking was that after these were found, then I'm getting ahead of myself a bit. I'm sorry, but the KGB, to make a small shift, had trouble with its pension fund, and they needed a little money. So they contacted Crown Books and said they would give them some access to some secret files if, you know, they pay them some money. So the Soviets, or the Russians, they weren't Soviets anymore, Russians got a man called Alexander Vasilyev. As he was a journalist as well as he'd also been a member of the KGB. And he was allowed to go to a press office, not into the archives, into a press office where he was delivered various papers by somebody. And he was allowed to take notes, not to photograph, not to take them away, but just to take notes. And he is the one on whom they base all of the rest of their information on Alger. But if you look at what they've got, what they've done, there's a lot about Alish. Alish was clearly a rather important spy. But there is no reason to believe that he was Alger. And in fact, Vasiliev himself testified in court in 2003 that he had no reason whatever. He saw no identification between the two. And that he had told Weinstein so several times. He'd made the point of it, and he was very angry that his research had been so bungled. But what shocked me, I think, is to find that these respectable academics would quote this material from Vasiliev's notebooks, all of which are available online, and it would say Alish, and they would simply put in Alger Hiss.
That is surprising.
And why they're doing this, your guess is as good as mine.
Well, that is surprising that academics would do that.
Yeah, me too.
Your father was an academic, a pink a pink professor. Is that right?
Yes, economics.
But tell us about that. Was he? He fell in some political difficulties.
Well, yes, he did. He was on the left. He was not a communist. I even have his FBI file, which basically says that. But he was on the left, and he had strong feelings about equality and things like that.
Imagine.
Democracy, and he was a very, very strong anti-fascist. He was dubbed as a premature anti-fascist.
Oh, that's such a good
title. Isn't that marvelous phrase?
Well, that applied to the Abraham Lincoln Brigade that fought against the fascists in the Spanish Civil War as well.
Absolutely.
Some heroes.
They were equally bad.
Yeah. But you know,
the idea was that at that point only communists were against Hitler.
Oh, I see. I often wondered
so
about
the fact that.
That
he was against Hitler and against fascism made him a communist, and he was hounded. It was a very difficult time for him.
You know, I was going to say, I've often wondered about the phrase premature anti-fascist. You're supposed,
isn't it wonderful?
I mean, what are you supposed to wait till there's a couple of million people dead? I mean, when is it okay to be an anti-fascist?
I'm not quite sure when it became okay. But clearly he was before it was okay.
Oh, clearly. I would have been proud of that. And, you know...
I am.
Oh, I'm sure. The whole anti-communist thing didn't begin, as you point out, with the House Un-American Activities Committee in the McCarthy period. The fear of communism has proved to be very useful in terms of political ambitions in the U.S. for about a century now.
It was marvelous. There was a period of time there when you literally could not run for office unless you were red-baiting.
God, it's a little bit more difficult now, I suppose. I mean, now we don't have the Reds to go after. And it's curious to me how Republican states got to be red states. I mean, it used to be to say red was just, oh, my goodness. Yeah, but the communists have been around, a legal party during, you know, the anti-war movement against the First World War.
Yeah.
And they were discredited, part of the way of discrediting the peace movement, of which there was a big peace movement in the Midwest, all over the place. Republicans didn't want to go to war either. But calling them communist was a special way to discredit them, even though it was a legal party. Like, you know, the Socialist Party, Debs ran for president, got a million or so votes, something like that.
Well, they did an awful lot of good stuff. I mean, with the unions and with the ideas of equality, both for women and for other people.
Right, right. And nobody else was talking about it. As I recall, in the 30s, it wasn't such a big deal to be a communist, because if you were against segregation and for equality, who else was talking about that? The Communist Party.
Well, I think quite early, it was probably much less... stigmatized.
Yes,
and I think one
yes,
of the things
yes.
that always seems to me very appealing about that period is that people believed they could make a change. And whether it was this way or Roosevelt's way, but they thought they could. They thought they had some, it was a bit like the 60s.
Yes.
In the sense that there was a sense that there was something we could do.
Well, I think that's been kind of reborn, thank you, Donald Trump. I mean, he's creating the resistance better than anybody. I mean, I used to say during the anti-Vietnam War movie, our best organizer was Nixon. Now, you know, the resistance. And one of my favorite, talk about making a difference in who we are and justice. One of my favorites in American history was William O. Douglas, who was the longest serving justice in the Supreme Court.
William O. Douglas.
What did he have to say about the Hiss trial?
What he said was that no court could possibly uphold the verdict. And his own did.
What was the verdict? What was he charged with?
What
was he convicted of?
What he was charged with was actually taking the material from Whitaker Chambers in 1938.
That was the charge?
The charge, you know, for delivery to the Soviet Union.
Don't they need evidence?
Not for perjury. See, that's the thing. What's interesting is that they couldn't charge him with espionage because the limitations had run out. But that was not a bad thing for Alger. It was a wonderful, I mean, it was a bad thing for Alger, not a good thing. A wonderful thing for Nixon, because he could bring these perjury charges. He didn't really have to do much except bring up what seemed to him doubts. If it was espionage, you had to have proof.
Yes, but perjury.
You had to have an actual action that had to have been seen by several people. I mean, they did this with Judith Copeland. And there had to be material of danger to the state that was recovered. They had none of that. But they could keep implying all these things. And there were those three canisters that nobody had ever seen.
Well, I wanted to ask, Alger Hiss has been called America's Dreyfus. How does history view France's prosecution of Alfred Dreyfus? And do you think history may similarly vindicate Alger Hiss? Dreyfus was in the 19th century. The big thing was the anti-Semitism, that he was Jewish, but he was not guilty of anything, even though he paid a high price for it.
I think they're very similar.
Tell us.
I think it was Piers Paul Reed who said, how could it be that France, the most civilized of nations, could be brought up, could be caught up in this barbarism? And this is similar. This is a barbarism.
And you saw Alger Hiss shortly before his death. How had he managed to live a happy life after all he had been through?
You know, it's a difficult thing. I'd known him for 30 years, and he was one of these people. He was just an optimist. He had maybe high serotonin levels, for all I know. I mean, he basically was a happy man. What he said about the 4 years or nearly 4 years in prison was that it was a good antidote to Harvard. I mean, this is an extraordinary. And he was very popular in prison. When he left, the prisoners, all cheered and sang and things, wished him well. And he had friends. He kept friends from some of them all his life.
And boy, Nixon was the one. He's the guy that
Nixon was the one.
Oh my goodness! So it's now nearly 70 years after the fact. Why is this story of Alger Hiss and Richard Nixon something people might want to read?
This is a question, and it's not one I can answer. I really don't know. I think partly it has to do with the fact of the House Un-American Activities and the fact that that was 30 years and millions and millions and millions of dollars and thousands of destroyed lives. And he justifies it. He's the only justification. There is no other reason for that reign of terror. And that was what it was. It was a reign of terror. People killed themselves. Their lives were destroyed.
Yes.
There was this one guy who got caught up in it only because his name was the same as somebody who had been subpoenaed and who had been published in the paper, and his life was ruined. His neighbors threw rocks at his window. It was a terrible, terrible time, and I don't think anybody's actually done justice to it as a thing on its own, as except The Crucible, possibly. Miller's The Crucible, that did it, but not with the actual people.
Well, it's good to learn about witch hunts and sham trials like that. And you write parallels with terrorism are hard to escape. What do you mean by that?
I think they're certainly there. I mean, there's that marvelous quote by George Kennan when he says that if communism or if the Soviet Union falls beneath the ocean, we're going to have to find something else, or the economy won't be able to bear it.
Uh-huh. And we've done
and
that.
I think what's come up really is terrorism.
Yes.
It's a way to unite us with fear.
Yes, it is. And you could replace the word communist with terrorist and just...
You could indeed, easily. And it all makes a bit more sense. I mean, you can see why, you know, when they say this is a man who has a Cocker Spaniel dog, and we know that he has this place, and we've been there, instead of thinking of it as a communist situation, you think of it as a jihadist situation, and you begin to think, well, yes, I can sort of see that. You know, how would he know he has this Cocker Spaniel dog if he hasn't been there making bombs with him?
No. And I can think of cases throughout the world. The fascist in Turkey, Erdogan, calls his opponents terrorists. In various right-wing regimes throughout the world, they call their opponents terrorists, like they used to call them communists.
Except ours, of course, when they're nice and white, as in Charlottesville.
Yes. Right. The real terrorists.
Mm. Yeah.
The book is Alger Hiss Framed, A New Look at the Case That Made Nixon Famous. Fascinating story, stranger than fiction, that's for sure. Our guest has been its author, Joan Brady. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
The rocket.